Good afternoon, America. This is Mark Levine. Welcome to the Inside Scoop, where we bring you all the news from Washington that the government does not want you to know. I'm a former congressional attorney. I used to work there in Congress in the House Judiciary Committee and also in the House Homeland Security Committee. And I would go and I'd listen and I'd be surprised at all the information that we knew in Congress that was never conveyed to the American people. Serious stuff. Stuff like our planes weren't being protected. Our nuclear plants weren't being protected. Did you know that when you go on an airplane that your shoes are checked, that your bags are checked, but that bags under the plane are not checked, that mail is sent? That's right. If they send mail, it goes underneath your plane, packages that are not being explored. And we Democrats want to spend more money on Homeland Security. Not that much more, a few billion dollars. Compared to the president's war in Iraq, it's a pittance. Compared to the tax cut, you'd hardly notice it. But we tried to spend money. We tried to spend $4 billion basically buying up loose nukes in the former Soviet Union. President Bush said no. He threatened to veto these bills. They didn't go through. He said that we've just got to provide tax cuts to the upper middle class, to the very wealthy. Got to do things like help Anna Nicole Smith make sure that she's not taxed when the old man dies and she gets hundreds of millions of dollars, because that would be unfair. No, George Bush wants to tax working people, not those that earn money by inheritance. Well, what has that meant? What has that meant for all of us? What it's meant is, with tax receipts the lowest since 1950 and spending going up and up and up, we have by far the largest deficits in American history. Now, my program today is devoted to those deficits, or at least the first hour. We're going to have a guest from the Cato Institute. Now, the Cato Institute, I usually disagree with. They're for, I guess, less government in all circumstances. I think that sometimes government's good. For example, in Homeland Security or in education or health care, some basic things. But one thing we both agree on, myself and the people at the Cato Institute, is that there is reckless spending by the Republican Congress. Lots of pork barrel stuff, lots of corporate welfare, tens of billions of dollars going to corporations for tax cuts. In fact, it may be over $100 billion. We also have an energy bill full of all kinds of pork, all kinds of benefits to people who give to the president. And I want to hear from you. I want to know what you think. Do you think this Congress is spending too much? You know, what's ironic to me is that the Clinton administration declared the era of big government over and actually lowered spending. And for all the canards that the Republicans do, saying, oh, the big Democratic Congress, they spend too much and all this kind of stuff, they are spending way more. And what it shows is really the danger of one-party government. And listen, I know you folks, you go to your workplaces and you hear people say things around the water cooler, things like, oh, you know, we don't want those big spending Democrats, tax and spend, tax and spend. Well, what do we have from the Republicans? We have the lowest taxation, sure. Not cutting, by the way, your taxes. If you're lower or middle class, you barely got a tax cut. They're not cutting Social Security taxes. Social Security taxes, you may well know, are mostly on poor and middle-class people. If you make over 80 grand, you don't pay Social Security taxes anymore. Instead, he cuts taxes for the rich. So cutting wealthy people's taxes way down, we have the lowest taxes since 1950, and we also have the highest spending. And because of that, we have a huge deficit, far bigger than anything Reagan and Bush did, and of course, they dwarfed anything the Democrats did. So I want to talk about this deficit. I want to talk about pork barrel spending. And I want to actually have my guest from the Cato Institute, who's going to be Chris Edwards, the director of fiscal policy studies. He's going to come on the air. And like I said, it's kind of neat when we Democrats and conservatives can both come together and agree that this Republican Congress has got to go. So he's going to be on a little bit later in the program. If you want to call in, and I hope you do, I hope you call in and talk to me and talk to my guest and challenge him. The number is 877-57-SCOOP. It's a toll-free number, 877-577-2667. I hope you'll call in and be heard. That's very much part of the program. Also, if you want to send me an email, the email address is mark, M-A-R-K, at radioinsidescoop.com. And, you know, I get a lot of information from Congress. I used to work there, as I said, and I get information not just from Democrats. but also from some Republicans and some Republicans in the administration. And in fact, I like to say that I've been bringing you the news before the mainstream press does. In fact, all the stuff going on now regarding Richard Clark, I reported last July about the administration planning the war in Iraq before September 11th, not focusing on al-Qaeda. And now it's finally coming out. I mean, I reported way back in July regarding Sandy Berger's giving to Condoleezza Rice very clear instructions. The first primary threat to America is al-Qaeda. Don't worry about Saddam Hussein. And, you know, they didn't listen. And this is finally coming out now, and I really think it's going to be harmful to the Bush presidency. But let me talk first about spending, because I think we've got a lot to talk about in that regard. The great spending of this Republican Congress, lots of pork to talk about. And we'll be back with more pork, more Republican spending, and more of the Inside Scoop right after these messages.
I'll tell you, today on Hightower Radio. Sometimes when I see those in power pull some political action that's stupid, I say to myself, what were they thinking? But a recent action by the Bushites is so obtuse, so blindingly stupid, that you can only conclude that no thought at all was involved, that no one with the brain power of a single-cell amoeba could have been consulted on such a perverse decision. The Bush incident revolved around a bit of political fluff that the White House tried to foist on us last Labor Day. With his jobs record rivaling Herbert Hoover's, and with every industry from manufacturing to high tech sending hundreds of thousands of U.S. jobs offshore, Bush's political handlers decided that he needed to do something. Not really do something in the sense of stopping our country's middle class bleeding, but appear to do something. So, George announced that he was creating, ta-ta, a new Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Manufacturing. Big whoopee. A new bureaucrat to do what? To be a cheerleader and provide political cover, of course. That was stupid. But then came stupid on steroids. 6 months after announcing this position, Bush finally got around to appointing his new manufacturing czar. It was Anthony Raimondo, a Bush campaign contributor and the CEO of a manufacturing outfit in Nebraska. Fine. Since he's from the biz, he might have an actual idea about how to stop offshoring. But no. Guess who had recently fired 75 of his own corporation's U.S. workers and built a new factory in China to employ 180 workers? Yes, Anthony, our new czar. This is Jim Hightower saying, this was too embarrassing, even for Bush's White House of big blunders, so Anthony's name was withdrawn. But it shows how clueless the Bushites are. As Senator Charles Schumer put it, this White House is so bad at jobs, it can't even fill the one it created.
Federal college loan rates are currently lower than they have ever been, which means by refinancing now, you could cut your monthly student loan payment by up to 50%. By calling 1-800-2-COLLEGE, you'll quickly be connected to College Loan Corporation. We will answer your questions, help you lower your payments, and secure a rate as low as 2.63%. It's easy, it's free, and so far, over 300,000 people have called. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
When you're the voice of reason, very few things get you excited. So you wouldn't expect something like a good price on a great copier to be one of them. But when the subject is a Xerox digital copier that delivers 35 quality pages a minute for a surprisingly low lease price of $134 a month and is so advanced it can be upgraded to scan, fax, and even email, well, that's enough to even make the voice of reason pick up the phone.
Call 1-800-ASK-XEROX for business lease details. Additional per copy charge.
How stupid can the Bushites be? I'll tell you today on Hightower Radio.
We're back here on the Inside Scoop. This is your host, Mark Levine, bringing you all the news from Washington that the government does not want you to know. Our topic today is government spending in Congress and the huge deficit, and also Bush's tax cuts. We want to know what the results are going to be of this deficit. How are we ever going to pay it back? Who's causing it? Why do we have this huge deficit? And to discuss this, I've invited on air a guest from the Cato Institute. Now, the Cato Institute, his name's Chris Edwards, by the way. He's director of fiscal policy studies. I'll let him explain from his view what the Cato Institute does. My understanding is that they're an institute for smaller government. Now, I will disagree with the Cato Institute on many things. I think that certain things definitely we don't provide enough for. I can think of child care for working mothers or health care or education that I may disagree with the Cato Institute on. I would hope they'd agree with me that we're not giving enough on homeland security and things like that. But I think what we will agree on is the huge amount of pork being spent by this Congress. Totally useless things. Things like a rainforest in Iowa. Did you know that was in the omnibus bill? We're spending money to do a rainforest in Iowa. Well, I guess that makes sense because Iowa doesn't have any rainforests. Maybe they need one. For perspective on this, I want to invite my guest, Chris Edwards. And if you want to call in, the number is 877-57-SCOOP. That's a toll-free number. I hope you'll join in the debate. 877-577-2667. Chris Edwards, welcome to the Inside Scoop. How are you, sir?
Good. Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, now tell me, first of all, I think most of us working inside the Beltway know what Cato is, but some of my listeners may not. Why don't you explain what the Cato Institute does?
Well, I think you basically got it right. It's as simple as that. We believe in small and limited government across the board. We believe in civil liberties on the economic side. We believe in free markets, free enterprise, low taxes, and reduce government regulation.
Okay, let's go right to the point. Let's go right to the big, massive deficit. Now, a deficit's caused by two things, and we'll deal with each of them. One is, of course, it's basically spending beyond your taxation. So deficits go up when you increase spending, and they also go up when you lower taxes. Let's talk first about increased spending. Has spending gone up in the current Congress?
Oh, of course, absolutely. Under President Bush, just in 3 years, the total federal budget, total spending has gone up 24%. That's a lot more than I'm sure most folks have seen their incomes go up in the last few years.
So 24%. Now, what did it go up in the Clinton Congress?
Didn't go up that much, other than the spending on Social Security and the entitlements that are always rising quickly. Spending on the rest of the government didn't go up very much. For one reason, during the 1990s, defense spending was falling, of course, and that helped President Clinton. But even if you look at, your typical programs like education, spending didn't go up very much under Clinton, but, has exploded under President Bush.
So, my understanding is that Clinton's budget went up about 2% a year. Does that sound about right to you?
Right, that sounds about right. Now, of course, President Clinton, for most of his tenure, had a Republican Congress that was interested in controlling spending. The problem now is we've got a unified Republican government, and no one is interested in controlling spending anymore. Republican Congress has sort of moved to the left because they don't have a Democratic president to bonk on the head.
You call it move to the left. Is someone left of center? I guess I wouldn't use that term. Let's just say they've become big spending. That's something we can agree on.
They've embraced the welfare state. I mean, the Medicare drug bill, for example, used to be exactly the type of thing that the Republican Party would oppose when Ted Kennedy introduced such legislation. These days, and in the new Congress, the recent Congress, the Republicans have embraced that type of welfare state.
Well,
program.
Speaking of the Medicare bill, and I want to talk about other things Republicans Congress has done, but this Medicare bill, of course, is very different from one that Ted Kennedy might propose. Ted Kennedy voted against this bill. This bill provides mostly huge amounts of money, hundreds of billions of dollars, to America's pharmaceutical companies, and much less to seniors. I mean, at least Ted Kennedy's Medicare bill would have provided the benefits directly to the Americans that need them. This bill, the Bush bill, gives all this money, hundreds of billions, to pharmaceutical companies now, and only provides benefits to people who might need them in 2006. So, you can characterize it as an entitlement. I would characterize it as corporate welfare. But in any case, we can both agree that it was pretty large.
Oh, absolutely. And as we've discovered recently, the government sort of didn't give us the straight facts about the bill. Bush promised a $400 billion bill, and now they think it'll be at least $540 billion. And that's only in the first 10 years. Remember, what starts happening early next decade is that all this massive these gray-haired Americans start retiring and collecting Medicare and Social Security, and that's when the cost of the drug bill really goes into overdrive, and they think it could cost as much as $2 trillion in the second 10 years of this bill, which is just a huge burden to put on the next young generation of workers.
I want to emphasize that Chris Edwards is from the traditional conservative school. I'm definitely a liberal, and he's from the traditional conservative school, but we can both agree that Republican spending is out of hand. Of course, in the Medicare bill, a lot of us know in the recent news that the Bush administration knew that bill would cost $540 billion, and in fact, a lower-level bureaucrat wanted to tell Congress the truth and was threatened with being fired if he told them the truth. So clearly this is something that the Bush administration is very embarrassed about. But I want to go on to your next point, Chris, about Medicare and Social Security. It's true that we've known for a long time, because of the baby boom generation, that there's this bump in the population, and that they're working now, but they're going to retire soon. And frankly, my generation, those of us under 40, Gen X, we have to worry, because now we have a smaller generation supporting a bigger generation. And, of course, Alan Greenspan has said, we're not going to get Social Security, my generation. Now, Bill Clinton had a way to solve that problem. Back in the time of Bill Clinton, because spending was low and taxes were higher, we were running a huge budget surplus. And Clinton's plan was to devote half that budget surplus to saving Social Security. Obviously now we have this huge deficit, and Bush has broken into the lockbox, Al Gore's lockbox, if you will, and taken all the Social Security money, and it's gone now. And I want to know what you think about it, folks, and I want you to call in and challenge our guest, see what he thinks. The number here is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-2667. I hope you'll call in and be heard. Let me go to one caller right now. Caller, you're on the air. What's your first name and where are you from?
I'm Ron, and I'm in the great state of Indiana.
Hello, Ron from Indiana. What's your comment on government spending?
I considered myself a social liberal, but kind of a fiscal conservative, and I never did like this tax and spend thing that went flying around, and I always thought that was pretty bad. But what we're seeing now is the one thing that is worse than that, and that is borrow and spend. Spending enormous amounts of money, which most of us agree on is by and large squandered, without this magic money, which is going to be passed on to my grandchildren and their children. It's going to be passed on to someone.
I speak all the time before high school students. I do that. I debate. We do liberal-conservative debates all the time. And I tell them, hey, 10, 20 years from now, you're not going to be paying just your taxes for that government. You're paying taxes for the current government.
As far as I'm concerned, what they've been doing now in Washington, and I'm not just saying the president, but also our Congress, I don't know where these characters learned their economics, but it borders on criminal. I mean, it's just ridiculous. At some point, the rest of the world is going to stop financing our government, and we're going to see one real major economic blow up in this country. And I'm just afraid that it's getting closer than more. And I'm old enough to have seen similar things happen in this country and in other countries, so I know that. But somehow most of my fellow Americans have this feeling, well, this is the United States and nothing really bad can happen. And well, if you've got any age on you and you've read any history, that just isn't true.
Hang on, Ron. I want to get a comment from Chris. Chris,
okay.
Is Cato really concerned about deficits?
Well, actually, this caller hits really the nail on the head in that, he's outraged morally, from my impression of his comments, about the gigantic deficit and how we are pushing it on to the next generation. And that's absolutely true. I think it's irresponsible for Congress to spend more money, essentially, than the taxpayers are authorizing them to spend. However, the economic effects of the deficit are really unclear. I mean, the Democrats are saying now that, the deficits will push up interest rates. But we haven't really seen that happen. So I don't know whether there will be a financial crisis at all from these deficits, But for sure, the gigantic deficits will boomerang back on President Bush, I think, because they will cause future Congresses, you know, to consider tax increases and to repeal Bush's tax cuts to pay, you know, to lower these deficits, which is really unfortunate. I think, you know, Bush has got to control the spending in order to, you know, to make sure that the taxes don't go up on the next generation.
Well, I want to deal with both those questions. But first, I guess, as someone who's an economics major myself, I got a degree at Harvard in economics, I want to be clear about interest rates. The way it works is, if you borrow more money, long-term interest rates go up. Now, the Fed, the Federal Reserve Board, in the short term, can lower interest rates by doing what they've been doing, and they've lowered it to the lowest they can in 30 years to 1%. But what happens is more and more government spending happens, that there's a point where the Fed can't lower it. They can't lower funds below zero. That's
right,
their
the
limit.
Long-term rates, is if you look at mortgage rates, have started falling again. And those are the exact, you know, long-term rates that the Democrats have argued would go up when the deficit rose, and that really hasn't happened. And
well,
you know, and part of the issue is, of course, is that, you know, the U.S. government now borrows from creditors throughout the entire world.
Right.
Interest rates are set globally.
Right.
And so, you know, so the economic effects of the deficit are really unclear. But this caller is right that it's morally outrageous to push the cost onto the young folks.
May I interject?
One second, Ron. I just want to respond, and then Ron, I'll definitely get to you.
Okay.
My point is that we have to take into account the economy as well. Again, in economics, the other thing that increases interest rates is a decent economy. Because our economy is so lousy, that is one reason why interest rates are not as high as they're going to be when we get a recovery. Now, it may take a Democratic president to get that recovery, but go ahead, Ron.
Well, there has been an economic effect. If you just look at the value of the dollar versus the euro, you can see that effect. And true, at this point, we haven't seen much of a deleterious effect, but that's like saying, well, on September the 10th,
yep,
year 2000, we hadn't seen two buildings fall down. But people who are smart and who read history, you know, the time to fix a problem is before it occurs. And, you know, after the thing blows up in our face, then there's not going to be much we can do about it. I guess that's my two cents, Chris.
Well, thank you very much for calling.
You're welcome.
I appreciate your two cents. And if you want to call in and make a comment as well, please do. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-2667. Or you can send me an email by sending to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. Chris, I want to go on from the deficit and talk about some of the details of some of the spending programs. In addition to the Iowa rainforest, I also found that Ted Stevens of Alaska is insisting that crab manufacturers, talk about, you know, stuff, has to go to one of two companies that that apparently also give to his campaign.
That's
very
right.
Convenient.
I mean, Ted Stevens is really what is wrong, everything that's wrong with Congress these days. The Los Angeles Times ran a very good story about a month ago about how Ted Stevens has enriched business partners and relatives back home in Alaska from his years in the United States Senate. And, you know, he's an infamous porker. The highways in Alaska and other infrastructure is way overbuilt because he's a powerful member of Congress. And, you know, this is enormously inefficient. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, Cato and other groups think that, you know, the federal government ought to get out of a lot of these areas, like highways, that were traditionally state functions. It would be a lot more efficient if individuals in the various states determined whether they wanted rainforests or highways in their state. There's no reason for all this money to be channeled through Washington.
Well, I guess I'm going to disagree with you. I can certainly agree that we need no more Iowa rainforests. But highways, you know, particularly interstate highways, that's stuff that we all use. That's stuff that go. I mean, you wouldn't really want, it seems to me, some state decisions where you have one highway going one way ending at the state board and another highway ending at another point. I mean, that requires, certainly on the interstate, you know, that requires federal
aid
and
money.
Oh,
I don't think so. I mean, the states get together already to do all kinds of planning on cross-border issues. And there's no reasons why the 50 states separately couldn't get together and agree to certain standards on their interstate highways, and then just have local gasoline taxes and the local spending. The problem now is that fast-growing states like, say, Nevada, that might need more highway building, don't get the money because they don't have the powerful members of Congress, whereas states like Pennsylvania and West Virginia that are not growing happen to have very powerful members of Congress. They get all the highway funding, so it's extremely inefficient the way it works now.
Well, I certainly agree with you that it's unfair in the way that more powerful senators get funding, but at the same time, you know, if Nevada is growing more, I think that the federal government can help and see that and see that maybe Nevada should get more funds. Or,
well, in theory, they should be able to, but that's not the way. That's not the way. You know, it's horse trading up on Capitol Hill. It's not rational the way these decisions are made. That's the problem.
Well, let me ask you though, in terms of spending. It seems to me, though, despite the fact that we've now shown that Bush spending has gone up 24% compared to Clinton's 2%.
Right.
My record shows that 3/4 of the deficit is caused by the tax cuts. Now, this is where I think you and I may disagree. But, first of all, let's just get our facts straight. What would you say is the percentage of the deficit caused by lower tax revenues?
Well, you know, the Bush administration's put out numbers on this that I think are generally correct, that most of the cause of the deficit is the economic recession, which really pummeled federal revenues. Federal revenues dropped substantially, for example, because capital gains tax revenues plummeted when the stock market fell. Corporate profits are down, so corporate profits tax revenues fell. With this automatic spending that takes place every year, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid spending automatically rises at 6, 7, 8% every year, just sort of automatically. Congress doesn't even have to do anything for the spending to increase. So I think that those are your main causes.
Well, one thing I think we should be clear is that I love the way the Bush administration says, the economy's on the rise, the economy's on the rise, but then when they talk about tax revenues, they say, oh, we don't have much tax revenues because the economy's lousy. So they kind of have it both ways there. I think if you look at it, the figures I've seen show that 3/4 of the problem with the deficit, 1/4 is runaway spending, 3/4 is lower tax revenue, and if you divide up that 3/4 further, you'll see that 1/4 is exactly what you say, Chris. It's the terrible economy that we've got under this administration, but that a full half the deficit is due to the Bush tax cuts.
Well, you know, see, the thing with taxes is this, is that even with Bush's tax cuts fully implemented and made permanent, federal revenues will continue to rise rapidly over the next few years. For one thing, as Americans become more prosperous, their incomes rise, they automatically get bumped into higher income tax brackets, and that creates this, you know, huge positive windfall for the government. So, I mean, we need a federal tax cut every few years just to sort of keep even with the government. I want to go back to something you said a little earlier, though, and that
you know
is,
what, Chris, can I just ask you to hold on? We got to go to commercial, and then I promise I'll get back to you and let you make your point, all right?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to be back with more of the Inside Scoop right after these messages. If you want to join in the discussion, please do so. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. It's a toll-free number. Please call in and join in the debate. You can also email me by sending an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. Back with more right after this.
Sometimes when I see those in power pull some political action that's stupid, I say to myself, what were they thinking? But a recent action by the Bushites is so obtuse, so blindingly stupid, that you can only conclude that no thought at all was involved, that no one with the brain power of a single-cell amoeba could have been consulted on such a perverse decision. The Bush incident revolved around a bit of political fluff that the White House tried to foist on us last Labor Day. With his jobs record rivaling Herbert Hoover's, and with every industry from manufacturing to high-tech sending hundreds of thousands of U.S. jobs offshore, Bush's political handlers decided that he needed to do something. Not really do something in the sense of stopping our country's middle-class bleeding, but appear to do something. So, George announced that he was creating, ta-ta, a new Assistant Secretary of Commerce for Manufacturing. Big whoopee. A new bureaucrat to do what? to be a cheerleader and provide political cover, of course. That was stupid. But then came stupid on steroids. 6 months after announcing this position, Bush finally got around to appointing his new manufacturing czar. It was Anthony Raimondo, a Bush campaign contributor and the CEO of a manufacturing outfit in Nebraska. Fine. Since he's from the biz, he might have an actual idea about how to stop offshoring. But no. Guess who had recently fired 75 of his own corporation's U.S. workers and built a new factory in China to employ 180 workers? Yes, Anthony, our new czar. This is Jim Hightower saying, this was too embarrassing, even for Bush's White House of big blunders, so Anthony's name was withdrawn. But it shows how clueless the Bushites are. As Senator Charles Schumer put it, this White House is so bad at jobs, it can't even fill the one it created.
Federal college loan rates are currently lower than they have ever been, which means by refinancing now, you could cut your monthly student loan payment by up to 50%. By calling 1-800-2-COLLEGE, you'll quickly be connected to College Loan Corporation. We will answer your questions, help you lower your payments, and secure a rate as low as 2.63%. It's easy, it's free, and so far, over 300,000 people have called. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
When you're the voice of reason, very few things get you excited. So you wouldn't expect something like a good price on a great copier to be one of them. But when the subject is a Xerox digital copier that delivers 35 quality pages a minute for a surprisingly low lease price of $134 a month and is so advanced it can be upgraded to scan, fax, and even email, well, that's enough to even make the voice of reason pick up the phone.
Call 1-800-ASK-XEROX for business lease details. Additional per copy charge.
We're back here on the Inside Scoop. We're discussing government spending. Bill Clinton said in the 90s that the era of big government was over, and the Republicans scoffed. They couldn't believe that Bill Clinton would actually cut down government spending. But he did. And in fact, we had some of the lowest levels of spending in recent times in the 1990s. That's no longer the case. As I've been discussing with my guest, Chris Edwards, the Director of Fiscal Policy Studies for the Cato Institute, the Bush administration has been way outspending the Clinton administration. The Clinton's administration at that time, 2% funding was going up, about 2% a year. At this point, Bush is spending 24% a year. And if you want to join in the debate, I encourage you to do so. The number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-SCOOP. Join in the debate. Chris, you were going to say something when I had to go to commercial. What was it?
Well, you know, one reason why Cato is, we're not Republicans, and to go back to one of your earlier comments, we believe that, that there's a lot of waste in the defense budget and national security budget as well. I think the failures in national security the last few years don't have anything to do with the spending levels. It has to do with the huge amount of mismanagement in the agencies, the FBI, the CIA, and other agencies.
Interesting.
I don't think that's a spending problem, and I think there is a lot of efficiencies there. I'll give you an example. We see story after story in the paper about how the new weapon systems, whether it's the F/A-22 fighter and others, the cost estimates keep going up year after year, and the government seems to purposely lowball a lot of these big procurement projects, and the cost later balloon to the surprise of taxpayers. And it's that type of sort of inefficiency and mismanagement, I think, within the Pentagon that, we need to take a look at, as well as all the other federal programs.
Well, what's interesting to me is that one of the earliest ads done by Bush against John Kerry was a complaint that he cut $1.5 billion that Kerry saw as wasteful military spending, and Bush apparently is trying to blame him for that. One of the things I found most wasteful in military spending was this whole missile defense program, which has never been shown to work. And what a lot of people don't know, but I remember on September 11th, because I was working in Congress at that time, that on the same day they attacked us, there was a hearing planned for Congress that day, and the Democrats were arguing we needed more money for counterterrorism and less less for this missile defense program that's never been shown to work anyway. And the Republicans, Bush threatened to veto the request for actual anti-terrorism bill, to put it all on the missile defense. And what we're finding now from Richard Clark and his testimony and his book before the his testimony before the 9/11 Commission and his book is that, Bush was still fighting the Cold War. And one of the reasons we've saved money under Bill Clinton was that he was no longer fighting the Cold War. He was putting money into more smaller and better ways to handle a military. I mean, the idea was that if you're going to confront small groups of people, it's not the same as fighting the Soviet military. And, of course, it was the Clinton military that managed to win the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan because there's about a two-year lag. I want to ask, though, in terms of waste in government, we mentioned some in the military. Where else do you see waste in government, Chris?
Well, we tally up every year what we call corporate welfare or business subsidies, and we figure that there's about $90 billion of corporate welfare in the federal budget. And these are giveaways to, farm subsidies, for example, and various export subsidies that go to companies like Boeing, and export subsidies to, Sunkissed Oranges and these sorts of things. So that's where I think, there's no justice in these sorts of programs. Farm subsidies, for example, America's farmers today, it's not like the grapes of wrath anymore. Most of them are large corporations or large family-owned corporations, and that's where these subsidies go, and they go to a very few number of crops, to families with incomes above the American average. So this is sort of like, reverse Robin Hood stuff here. A lot of these business subsidies, they go to people, to people who don't need it and don't deserve the money. So that's one area that we really have to look at.
You know, Chris, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that corporate welfare, one of the things I found most surprising, and again, this is something that I don't think has gotten a lot of press, is that George Bush wanted to do both give gifts, corporate welfare, to companies that had outsourced American jobs, companies that had actually even gone further than outsourcing, but actually moved offshore to the Cayman Islands, to Bermuda, to avoid paying American taxes. We had a fight in Congress, and the Democrats said, look, if you're going to move offshore to avoid paying American taxes, at the very least, you shouldn't get corporate welfare subsidies from the U.S. government. But Bush was defending these companies. So imagine, it hurts us two ways. A company moves to Bermuda, they pay less taxes, that hurts, and they get more taxpayer money, that hurts, and Bush was defending it. And I've always been surprised, and maybe the stuff is just seen as too complicated to be on the evening news. I don't know why, but the media, it seems to me, is not covering this kind of really blatant corporate giveaways.
Yeah, I agree that Bush has missed a big opportunity, for example, it really struck me a couple years ago when the whole Enron Corporation scandal really started hitting. That Enron Corporation got over $1 billion of U.S. government loan money from these two obscure federal agencies to go around the world and build environmentally damaging projects in India, and they wanted to run a pipeline through the Amazon rainforest. Enron got U.S. taxpayer money to do these sorts of projects. And, what strikes me is extremely outrageous. And Bush had an opportunity, I think, to come out sort of as a populist and, in a pro-taxpayer mode and say, look, we shouldn't, fund all these, these wasteful corporate giveaways like this and use Enron as a great example. So, he really has missed a lot of spending cut opportunities.
Well, and I think many of my listeners know this, but Ken Lay, the CEO of Enron, was the single largest campaign contributor to the Bush campaign, gave almost $1 million to the Bush campaign. Now, you would think to avoid the appearance of impropriety, at least Bush would not want to give all these giveaways to Enron, but apparently, the whole thing strikes me, and this actually goes into another topic, which is basically campaign finance reform, but when you talk about big spending in government, whether you're talking about Ted Stevens of Alaska, or frankly some Democrats like Robert Byrd of West Virginia, it goes on in both parties. I think it's worse now, as we've seen in the Republican Congress and the Democratic Congress, but when you're talking about George Bush and Enron, what we find is quid pro quo. I remember back Bob Dole of Kansas, he would, to support the ethanol industry, and they would give about $6 million to his campaign or the Republican coffers, and he would return with $6 billion in taxpayer money. That's 1,000 times your return. That's pretty good for a company. But I think when we have this kind of pork barrel spending, we end up with quid pro quo. I want to know if the Cato Institute would support a measure that would say, when we want to spend on something, for whatever it is, whether it's Pentagon, you know, toilets or highways or anything else, that we decide to spend the overall level of funds, but instead of giving them to individual companies in no-bid contracts like we're doing with Halliburton, instead we put it out to an independent commission, a non-political commission, whose only job is to make sure we get the best bang for our buck, to watch waste. And it would be, I don't know whether it'd be equally divided between Republicans and Democrats, or we would take, you know, bureaucrats that aren't from either party. But that way there'd be no connection between the political giving and the political taking. I wonder, do you think the Cato Institute would support that?
Well, I mean, the main reform that we would support is just cutting spending on a lot of these programs altogether. like rebuilding the entire Iraqi economy through Halliburton, is that type of thing we would cut altogether. You know, I do think we need more disclosure, and I'll give you an example. The federal budget is this massive thing that stands about 2 foot high on your desk, but nowhere in there are listed the companies who get federal welfare handouts like Enron. What I think that is, there ought to be another section of the budget that has a complete listing of all the businesses, big and small, that get the federal handouts. So at least there's a first step at disclosure there.
You know, and what we could do is, and I'm sure some enterprising American citizen will do this, is if you took that, and you also take what gifts they gave and to which members of Congress and to the president. So you could just make a very clear quid pro quo. Ken Lay gave $1 million to Bush, and Bush gave, you know, $2 billion of taxpayer money to Enron. And we can just sort of see exactly, because in my view, I know it is not illegal, but in my view it should be. To me, that is legalized bribery. And I think that we wouldn't have a lot of this runaway spending if we had things like public financing where we didn't have this quid pro quo going on. I do want to ask you, though, about the tax cuts, because I know we may disagree on this, Chris. But in terms of the tax cuts, let me see if I can get some agreement out of you. Would you agree that there are tax cuts and then there are tax cuts? In other words, if you give tax cuts to certain people, it's more likely to help the economy than if you give tax cuts to other people. And I'll be very specific. George Bush's tax cuts have gone overwhelmingly to people who earn a lot of money, whether it's $1 million or a couple hundred thousand dollars, to a lot of money. It's my view that people, lower and middle income people, are truly the engines of the economy. And let me just give you my theory here, and I want to see if you agree with it. If you're making $1 million, or making, let's say, $10 million a year, okay, you're making $10 million a year, and President Bush gives you $1 million more. You know, I don't think you're spending all that $10 million. In fact, you're probably not spending more than two or three. I don't know how you spend $1 million a year. I mean, maybe if you go and you have those fancy parties in Greece like some of those CEOs do. But, you know, how many yachts can you buy?
I think actually on this point I completely disagree.
Well, good. You disagree with me? Let me finish my point. Hold on. Let me finish my point and then I'll let you disagree with me. Here's my point. I don't believe it's true that if you make $10 million and you get $1 million more, suddenly you're going to increase jobs in your factory. And I'll give you a specific – and I'm going to get – you can respond. Let me finish my point. I think that if you've got a factory and let's say they make lamps, because I'm looking at a lamp right now. They make lamps, and there's a certain demand for lamps. People buy so many lamps a year. If you make more money, rich guy, owner of lamp factory, but there's no more demand for your lamps, then why are you going to hire more people?
Right.
You're richer. You're not going to hire more people. Let me just finish my point. But if we take that same $1 million going to the rich guy, and instead we split it up among 100 people each making $10,000 a year, okay, or more, let's say $30,000 a year, but we give 100 people $10,000 instead of one guy $1 million. Now, these are people who are making $30,000 a year, they're struggling to pay their rent, they're struggling to make a living, and they're gonna spend that money. They need the money, you know, whether to buy lamps, you know, so they can light up their house, or to send their kids to college or whatever. Lower and middle class people are gonna put that money in the economy. I think the rich person is much less likely to put that money in the economy, but that's my point, Chris. Take it away.
Well, I mean, basically, you know, I completely disagree with what you say. And there's two ways to understand how the economy works. One is the Keynesian way, and that's to think that it's demand that drives what goes on in the economy. The other basic way is what's called supply-side economics. Supply-side economics says that if we get out of the way of the producers and the entrepreneurs, for example, by lowering taxes on their profits, they will strive to earn more, start new companies, and create more jobs. And I think it's that view that is correct.
But if you're making $10 million a year...
The way to think about tax cuts is not so much that you're putting money into the pocket of the entrepreneur or the small business or big business. It's that you're cutting the tax rate on his marginal or additional investment.
Okay, but how is that going to sell more lamps? How is that going to sell more lamps? That's my example.
It's not
look
so
at the
much
lamp.
The selling of the lamps. It's that will a company build the new factory here in the United States to produce lamps? He is more likely to if you say that we are going to reduce the amount of the government share on your profits.
See, I don't think so. I think what happens is the company gets the money and more of it goes to the CEO salary, and it seems to me you don't, and let's do cars because that's a better example than lamps. If poor people get enough money, they might buy a new car because they're a one-car family, and now they can be a two-car family and they can take two jobs. It's useful. But it seems to me that if you don't get greater demand for cars, they're not going to, that's what the demand for cars will decide whether we build a new car factory. If you give the CEO of GM, you know, $100 million instead of $50 million, why is he going to build a new car factory?
We're not giving the money to the CEO. What we're doing is we're saying if you invest more money, if you build a new factory, we are going to cut the taxes on the profits you're going to earn from that factory. And I think we all agree that it's profits that drive the decision-making in businesses big and small country.
But it's profits based on demand.
The profits they'll invest
No, because it seems to me that it's one thing if you make profits because you sell more cars. All right, now you have to build a new factory, you have to increase jobs. If you make profits just because the president hands you a check for $1 million, then why is that an incentive to give more jobs?
No, but you're cutting the marginal tax rate. So in other words, corporations pay 35% right now on every additional unit of profit they earn. If you cut that to, say, 25%, corporations will earn more on that marginal investment, more on the additional
factory. And how does that create jobs?
And that will give them an incentive to
do
build
what?
More factories.
Well, now, wait a minute. If the company's selling 100 cars, how are they going to sell one more car just because they're making a greater marginal rate? How is that going to – why will they build a new car factory and create jobs if there's no more demand for cars? Please explain that to me if you can.
Well, I mean, there will be one because I mean, you forget that we're in within the international competition here. Our car companies, American car companies, compete against Japanese and European cars. You know, the issue is U.S. production efficient? And you know, and how you know people are concerned now about the Chinese imports and this sort of thing. I mean, one thing we've got is a really inefficient tax code, and companies are part of the reason why they're moving abroad is because of our horribly unproductive and uncompetitive tax system. It seems to me we're shooting ourselves in the foot unless we have a tax system that is low and reasonable. And simple for businesses to comply with.
Hey, Chris, I know that you said you had to go now, but do you have time to tangle with one of my callers?
Okay, sure.
Okay, caller, you're on the air. What's your first name and where are you from?
Jeff calling from Denver.
Jeff from Denver. What's your comment? Are you going to tangle with me or are you going to tangle with Chris?
Well, one is Chris. I mean, I totally think Mark's got you on this last argument. But the earlier thing that you're talking about as far as one is, it's great, let's tackle defense because... Actually, I'd like to say military rather than defense because a lot of it is BS. The thing you said about showing who donated the money, yes, please, let's show where the money comes from. But, you know, one thing we have to look at besides just this big missile defense thing is I know the head of a base who was given $10 million this year that he didn't need, he didn't want. But, DOD says you got to spend this money. He had to really struggle to find where to spend this $10 million.
Wow, $10
There's
million.
A lot of military money like that.
Wow. That's amazing. So, I mean, do you have a question for Chris about that? I guess you agree with us then.
It's mostly just support. It's nice to hear someone for once. I'm supporting it. Let's talk about the military.
Right.
The military is not sacred.
Well, one of the reasons why I'm really glad that I invited Chris was that it's a good example of where we Democrats can make allies on the other side. I mean, the Cato Institute, I've been reading their report, and let me just read to you some things that it says, just the highlights. It says, after only 3 years in office, President Bush may be heading to the record books as one of the biggest spending presidents. It also says, Bush has shown a clear preference for big government without regard to cost. Only Lyndon Johnson, in the years of Vietnam, outpaced President Bush's spending. And it just goes on and on and on. And it's just interesting to me that Republicans call themselves fiscal conservatives. But today, if you're a fiscal conservative, I think you need to vote for the Democratic Party. Hey, thanks very much for your call, Jeff.
Thank you.
All right, we got another caller on the line. Caller, what's your first name and where are you from?
Hi, this is Mike from Minnesota.
Hi, Mike. How are you, sir?
Very good. How are you, Mark?
I'm good.
Great.
What's your comment?
I just wanted to try to make a point in saying that supply-side economics is biased towards corporations, and it helps them keep the money that they make in the areas that they're at. And I think if you take what you said, Mark, redistribute some of that money and give it to some people who are struggling, you might find more entrepreneurs that way. You don't take a lot of money to start businesses and to start paying your way and start getting involved in society. You've got to let people create wealth for them, for this whole society to succeed. And now corporations dominate with all the profit, and it needs to be redistributed.
You know, I don't think Chris ever could explain how we're going to get one new car bought if, the rich guy, he's got all the cars he needs. He's got seven, all right? Is he going to buy eight? But the poor, the lower, the middle-class person struggling might just be able to afford another car if they got a tax cut. And I don't think you ever responded to that. You know, the difference between Keynesian economics and supply-side economics. Now, you know, when I learned when I was an economics undergraduate at Harvard, was that Keynesian economics made sense. I mean, the New Deal did bring us out of the Great Depression. And what that means is because lower and middle-class people are the engines of the economy. Supply-side, you know, the economic gods have not looked kindly on supply-side economics. I remember way back in 93, when the Wall Street Journal had an editorial, and they said, if Bill Clinton raises taxes in 1993, the whole economy will go down. We will have another recession. It'll be worse than the recession under George Bush Sr. The economy's just going to go to hell, is what they said. And lo and behold, we had the best economy in American history. Not only did the poor and middle class get richer, but hey, the rich got richer too. Everyone did better under the Clinton economy. And then you had Bush saying, if we cut taxes, you know, the economy will jump like we've never seen, and we have the worst recovery since Herbert Hoover. So I don't know what these supply-side economists are reading, or what theories they're looking at, but clearly it hasn't been true in our economy.
I believe that it strictly benefits the ultra-rich and the corporations that are frankly fleecing the people and the areas they exist in, I think.
And they're contributing to the Bush campaign, too.
For their people who work for them and the profits that are made. Because without the people and this country, they are nothing. And they've made incredible amounts of money, and they need to be responsible for it to a certain extent that way.
I could agree with you more, Mike. Mike, we got to go to a commercial. Do you want to stick around till after break, or did you say your piece?
Sounds good.
Okay, so you stick around, and we're going to go to a break. And after this, we're going to hear from more of your calls. The number here is 877-57-SCOOP. That's 877-577-2667. It's a toll-free number. Call in, be heard, challenge me, challenge Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute. Actually, he'll probably have to go soon. But call in. Let's talk about government spending. Let's talk about taxes. Let's talk about how it affects the political campaign coming up. And coming up later in the hour, I've found on The Daily Show, to me, the first answer I've ever heard to how it is that straight couples are harmed by gay marriages. I have argued for a long time that there's absolutely no harm done to straight couples by gay marriages. But Jon Stewart and his senior moral analyst, Stephen Colbert, has found a way that it really harms straight people. We're going to come up with that at the end of the hour. I think that'll be really funny. So, again, the number is 877-57-SCOOP. Call in. We'll have more of the Inside Scoop right after these messages.
News break from the Minuteman News Service.
This is Don Waller in New York. Former White House counterterrorism expert Richard Clark accused the Bush administration on Tuesday of going on the offensive against him to divert attention from the truth that the administration did virtually nothing about al-Qaeda prior to September 11, 2001. Clark, author of the newly released book Against All Enemies, also said the administration focused on alleged Iraqi ties to the terrorist attacks, while there was no evidence that Saddam Hussein's dictatorship was involved. Clark said the White House is papering over facts such as in the weeks immediately after 9/11, the president signed a national security directive instructing the Pentagon to prepare for the invasion of Iraq, even though they knew at the time that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. Members of the federal panel that's been looking into 9/11 say they're not hearing from everyone they want to hear from. The panel has opened 2 days of hearings on the anti-terrorism efforts of the Bush and Clinton administrations before 9/11. The 10-member panel had invited National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice to testify. She declined, with the White House citing concerns about separation of powers. Former Democratic Congressman Timothy Raymer noted that Rice has been featured in the media disputing the claims in Richard Clark's book Against All Enemies. He suggests that the debate shouldn't be played out in the media, but before the panel. Top Democrats stepped up their attacks on George W. Bush's credibility on Tuesday, accusing the White House of abuses of power and trying to squelch dissent and bad news on a range of fronts. They recalled moves to discredit former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill, who questioned Bush's Iraq policy in a book in January, and the leaking of the identity of CIA operative Valerie Plame when her husband, former diplomat Joseph Wilson, accused Bush of hyping pre-war intelligence on Iraq. Senate Democratic Leader Tom Daschle of South Dakota said, "We are seeing abuses of power that cannot be tolerated. The president needs to put a stop to it right now. We need to get to the truth, and the president needs to help us do that." More news after this.
Military veterans deserve better. They must wait endlessly for basic health care from the Department of Veterans Affairs. If you or a military veteran you know is one of the many heroes waiting for VA health care, the American Legion wants to tell your story to your elected officials in Washington, D.C.
Visitors to a zoo in eastern India have been banned from laughing after a state politician said he found it offensive. It happened after members of a local laughter club visited the Sanjay Gandhi Botanical Garden and Zoo in Patna. The politician became angry when he saw the group laughing while he was walking past the director's office. After ordering them to stop laughing, he issued instructions to a zoo official banning laughter at the zoo. For Minuteman News Service, this is Don Waller in New York.
Minuteman News Break is a production of TakeBackTheMedia.com.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. This is your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about the runaway spending of the Republican Congress. And this may seem unusual to you. You know, Democrats are always being accused of being big government spenders. In fact, George Bush in the campaign is talking about tax and spend. And yet, what have we found? And even the Cato Institute agrees that the Republicans, they're the big spenders, not the Democrats. In fact, the Cato Report says, and this is a direct quote, "On big government spending and trade restrictions, it is hard to see how a Democratic administration would have been worse than the Bush administration." So I say, Democrats, stand firm. Don't let those people at the water coolers claim that they're, oh, well, you know, you ever heard someone say, you know what, I'm a social libertarian, but I'm a fiscal conservative, and therefore I vote the Republican Party? You ever heard anyone say that? Well, then you need to tell them, well, look, if you believe in social liberty, if you believe in freedoms, if you believe in a woman's right to choose, if you believe that gay people should have equal rights, if you believe in civil rights for all, well, obviously you have to be a Democrat, as the person admits. Social, libertarian, liberty, freedom, that's something the Democratic Party supports. But then if you're a fiscal conservative, you should be a Democrat. If the only thing you care about is avoiding runaway spending, you should be a Democrat. And when even the Cato Institute, which is, you know, the font of fiscal conservatism, they are an organization founded on smaller government, when even they say the Democratic Party's better on this, then I think people need to listen. The Democratic Party just spends more responsibly. Now, I'll be the first to tell you, and this is where I'll disagree with Cato, that there is beneficial government spending. I wouldn't support corporate welfare, but I do think, for example, loans to help families send children to college, definitely important spending. Basic health care, so that, you know, we don't have children dying in the richest country on earth because they can't get basic health care. These are things that I think most Americans would support. But, you know, what we have is runaway spending going to companies like Halliburton. And it's not being watched very carefully. If you want to call in and comment on this, I encourage you to do so. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can send me an email by sending an email to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. And before we went to break, I was talking with Mike from Minnesota. And Mike, we had to go to a commercial, but you're back on the air. You got further comments for me?
Well, I guess I just hung around, but I pretty much said what I was going to say. But just in general, is Scott still there?
No, I'm afraid he had to go. He only gave me an hour.
Okay.
So his name's Chris
oh,
Edwards.
Sorry, Chris.
And he had to go. So, what were you going to ask him? I'm curious.
No, I nothing. I just was wondering if he had any observations on what, you know, if somebody, you know, I know you two were talking earlier about no coverage on the fact that there's corporate welfare out there. I just don't think people literally understand it. It's so incredible. First of all, the corporations basically don't pay taxes at all anyhow, and then on top of it, they get corporate welfare. And I think if America realized that, this is something that slipped right under the wire. But
you know, you raise a really good point. No, hang on, because
sure.
Halliburton... One of the things Dick Cheney, as CEO of Halliburton, is very proud of doing is he managed to cut Halliburton's taxes 90%. Now, Halliburton, for all its kickbacks and stuff, no one argued it was a failed company. I mean, Bush ran a bunch of failed oil well companies. But Halliburton's a successful company. I don't think their profits went down 90% under Dick Cheney's reign. But one of the things he did is he moved Halliburton subsidiaries offshore. And that saved money. This is the same thing that we're talking about in the election today. And Halliburton did that. And, you know, and then there's corporate welfare. One more statistic to throw out. Republicans, and you know, I've seen how, you know how it is. You go to work and you got some people in the workplace and they're Republican or maybe members of your family are. And they say, well, I just hate welfare. I hate the idea that they're welfare mothers and they're not working and they're taking money from my government and that makes me upset.
You're right.
Let's give a statistic. The amount of money total, the total federal money going to welfare mothers, going to women with children who can't work or on disability, all of that, $50 billion a year. Now that may sound large, but we spent $187 billion on Iraq, and we spent $160 billion on corporate welfare.
Yeah.
Three times the money. And whatever you feel about whether a poor child should have food to eat and clothing and shelter, you know, I don't know. I somehow that pulls at the heartstrings a little more than poor Enron. You know, poor Enron is going to go without its energy tax cut. I know, I don't think Enron's going to starve. In fact, Enron, of course, spent all the money and fired all its workers anyway because it was busy lining its own pockets. But three times the money on corporate welfare is on ordinary welfare. And so, you know, anytime someone says to you, well, you know, I worry about poor mothers. One other thing on that, by the way, is that Clinton, of course, in 1996 passed the welfare reform bill. And many, I guess, left liberals were opposed to that. I'm consider myself more of a moderate liberal or a moderate Democrat. I think it may have been necessary. But one of the things that Clinton did was he said that if you want to get welfare payments and you're not disabled, you should have to work. But as part of that, someone has to take care of the children of these mothers. And so one of the Democrats say, well, look, if you're going to make these women go to work, you need to have basic child care. And the Republicans have said, no, we're not going to give them child care. So I don't know what they're thinking. You know, the kids will live on the street. I don't know. But here again, they're giving all this money to Enron and to Halliburton. And they're saying, you women need to get to work and you need to take care of your children. And we're against abortions, right?
Exactly.
But we don't support child care for you. And then they wonder why there's crime in the streets. No, I don't understand this.
Yeah, well, I don't know if they they just moved to another neighborhood. That's all.
Yeah, it's amazing.
They don't wonder why there's crime. I think, don't you believe though that first? I think that this presidency is unraveling. As I kind of mentioned that before, but
Richard Clark,
think that this is just the first step. Don't you feel in a way though that we should try to wrestle the country back from the corporations and stop this type of a democracy, this corporate capitalism that we're living in, and maybe we could get a grip of this country.
Well, sure, but it's not easy. I mean, look who controls the media. I mean, you're listening to a very independent news source from me and from RadioPower.org, and I think it's terrific. But you know, we're small potatoes. Look at who owns NBC.
You know what's funny, Mark, is I monitor a lot of the right wing stations and programs, and I'm hearing more people calling in and challenging.
It's, well, that's good.
Flooding. All they're doing right now is they're defending themselves.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that they still haven't won over the American people. Okay, they took over our government. They used gerrymandering to get, one of the interesting things in Congress, for example, and you know this when you work there, but most Americans don't know this, is that if you look at the congressional districts across the country, we know, for example, in the 2000 election, that Al Gore beat Bush. I mean, pretty significantly. He beat him by 540,000 total popular vote count. Just as a way of comparison, by the way, Jimmy Carter beat Ford by 300,000, Kennedy beat Nixon by 100-something thousand, and Humphrey lost to Nixon by, again, that 100-something thousand. So you have Gore's margin over Bush was 2 to 3 to 4 times what these other three presidents' margin was in the popular vote.
Amazing.
But if you look at congressional districts, and, you know, I used to work for a member of Congress. We look very carefully at congressional districts. There are 435 congressional districts. Gore won only 195. Now, let me explain this math to you. If congressional districts were drawn so that they adequately reflected the population of America, Gore won, 50.5%. He should have 50.5% of the seats. You should have about 230 or so seats going for Gore, maybe 225 going for Gore, and 210 going for Bush, because that's the way the population works. Maybe it's a little bit closer, maybe it's 220, 215. The point is that Gore only won 195 seats. And the way they do this is by gerrymandering. What they do is they pack a whole bunch of Democrats in one district. Like in Florida, you should see the districts. They're amazing. They go along a highway, then they go out into the ocean for 100 miles. They come back in, grab a black neighborhood, go out to the ocean for 100 miles, come back in. Look at sometime when you get a chance, look at the congressional districts of Florida, and you will see a masterpiece of gerrymandering. Florida, as we know, has two senators that are both Democrats. They have a Republican governor, and we know that although Gore won Florida, and I can prove that if anyone challenges me on it, it was certainly a very close election, I'll grant it, between Gore and Bush. You would think that their congressional representation would be about half and half. Florida has 25 members of Congress. So you'd think, okay, so maybe 12 Republicans, 13 Democrats, or 13 Republicans, 12 Democrats. No, they have 18 Republicans and 7 Democrats.
Mm.
They have more than almost 3/4 of the seats are by Republicans, and that's because what they do is in the Democratic districts where they throw together, blacks and Jews and gay people and people who vote for the Democratic Party,
right.
They throw them all together and the Democrats win by 80 or 90%. Then they have other districts where the Republicans win by 60-40 or 55-45. And by doing that, it's a great way to disenfranchise large majorities of people. So they've done these tricks in the Congress to control the House. In the presidency, of course, we know Bush lost the election, but hey, Antonin Scalia and his four friends said, we're not going to let you count the votes. We're going to install you. But the important thing to remember, it's a long way of getting back to your original point, Mike, the point of all of this is that the American people, the majority of them, don't support this government. And even though it's not reflected in our so-called democracy, in the presidency, in the House, even though it's not reflected in our democratic institutions, the American people, the majority, do not support this government. And now you have corporations controlling the media, so we're not reflected there either. But just because everything you hear is right-wing, from the Congress, from the Supreme Court, from the President, from the media, Please remember out there, folks, we are the majority. And the only way to turn this around is to work harder in the elections. You know, it's like W.B. Du Bois said about African Americans 100 years ago. He said, you're going to have to work harder to get to the same place as white folk. You're just going to have to work harder. And we Democrats are going to have to work harder. We need to win by 5%. Because if we win by 1%, they'll steal the election again. And I think it's possible. I think we can do it. I think what we've seen from Richard Clark going on talking about how Bush failed on 9/11. I think the American people, we're becoming a greater majority. Not 52, but 55, 60. We've got to work harder, and I think we can pull it out.
I think we can, too. And I also believe that that we also I don't think that's really – I'm just – prognosticating, but I do believe that the group is falling apart and he will be defeated. But my worry is then, I mean, I believe in the Democratic Party too, but I just know that, you know, we're kidding ourselves if we think that the enemy is totally gone, if you know what I'm saying. And
the enemy is, I mean, we have domestic and foreign enemies. And they're totally there. And why I'm very glad. Listen, I went into independent radio from working in Congress because I felt I could do more good. When you're the minority party in Congress, particularly in the House of Representatives, you know, you don't control anything. Tom DeLay controls everything. We would get calls from constituents, and they would say, "Hey, why don't you hold a hearing on the Enron scandal? Why don't you have a hearing investigating where Bush was on 9/11?" You know, and we have to tell our constituents, we don't have a majority in Congress. We can't hold a hearing. We can't subpoena documents. We can't force the president's guys to come and testify before us. When you don't control at least one house of Congress, you're pretty powerless.
You know, what's interesting is just the same way that France changed their tune in 4 days, I believe that – I don't say it's going to happen, but I believe that the country could unite in that quick of a sense, and if they wanted to, they could unite and they could literally control anything. I think they could control, I think it's a way of, the only way that the actual people have, and I'm not talking about anarchy, I'm just talking about
here's the thing. We
organized,
have
or just like how the Move On.
Right, but we have to unite in the right ways. You know, I remember, again, when I was working in Congress, and I remember when the war in Iraq first started. By the way, if you want to join in this conversation, the number is 877-57-SCOOP. That's toll-free, 877-577-2667. Please call in and join this discussion. I remember when I was working in Congress and the war in Iraq started, and there were huge protests all over Capitol Hill. We had, I'm sure, more than 100,000, maybe even more than that, people come out and protest. And I went to the protest, and I talked to people there. And remember, at this time, I was working. I was counsel for Judiciary Committee, Homeland Security Committee. And I said to the people there, okay, you know, it's great that you got these signs and everything. Have you talked to your member of Congress? Well, no, we're just here for the weekend. Well, are you going to stay till Monday? Are you going to make an appointment? Are you going to talk to your member of Congress? No, we got to go. Well, have you called your member of Congress? Have you written your member of Congress? No, but we came all the way to Washington and said, we really care. We oppose the war. And yeah, I read them the Riot Act. I said, you think you're doing something here. You're wandering around. You're shouting, you know, no more war, no blood for oil. You're waving your signs, but you haven't talked to your member of Congress. You haven't. Have you contributed to a political campaign? Have you contributed to MoveOn.org? I mean, if you're not going to spend your time, at least you could spend your money. No, they hadn't. They wanted to march around with signs. And, you know, I support the right of Americans to protest, no question about it. I support free speech. But they could have done a lot better in influencing their government if they went home to wherever they were from, Minnesota or Iowa or Nebraska, wherever it was, Tennessee, and gone and worked in a political campaign to help elect a Democrat so that Tom DeLay didn't control Congress anymore. And I don't know why people don't get that.
Well, you're a lot more political than the average man. The average person, you know, maybe that's their only way of helping. And the people are helping in their own ways. And it's everybody's just not going to snap too. But it is kind of amazing that there is a resurgence of the attitudes and the tolerances that were learned in the 60s and things like that. And I think this with this war, the way things are, it seems like a repeat in a way, and a lot of people are feeling those same emotions. And anytime you get the group working the same way, get that positive momentum going. I mean, I don't want to get too spiritual, but I must say that I think a lot of people are coming to their senses, and what a perfect time for all these hits to be hitting the
yep.
Reagan, or the Reagan, excuse me, but the Bush administration.
Right.
But, so I guess I'm hoping and feeling that it, you know, you can in a way control that that dynamic. There's a lot of people that, I mean, in the old days when I was a younger person, my father would disagree with my politics. Now my father is old, very old, and he agrees with my politics, and so he has come around, and he is there's a lot of people now that are on this side, whether they're Gen X people or younger because of this war going on, and or older. So I really feel there's a mass. I think we're gonna wipe them out, to be honest.
You know,
I don't want to be too.
Well, you can't be complacent, because you've got to remember, Bush is going to have $200 million. And Kerry, last time I checked, was in debt. Now, MoveOn.org and some other groups are helping Kerry. But look, when a company gets huge amounts of taxpayer money, like Halliburton or Enron or Kenley, they got a lot of money to spend on political campaigns. And hey, it makes sense. If they spend $1 million and make $1 billion, that's a great investment.
Oh, yeah.
So they have a lot more money to spend. We only have the earnings of everyday American workers. We do have a few rich people on our side. George Soros, thank you very much.
Right.
Very good man. We appreciate that. I'm not saying that rich people can't contribute. I hope they do. And in fact,
I know they do. Right.
You know, like Bill Gates, for example. What's very interesting to me is that the water cooler stuff, whenever I'm talking with Republicans, you know, they're like, well, you know, I want to keep more of my money and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, you can't have class warfare and harm the rich. But you look at people like George Soros or even Bill Gates, and I got my own problems with Microsoft, but I'll tell you this. At least Bill Gates, George Soros, very wealthy people understand that they're only going to do well if the rest of the country does well. We're all in this together,
yeah.
Folks. And this idea that the rich can get richer and it'll trickle down, I mean, that's what they tried in the Reagan years. And I can't believe that they're trying it again. I mean, I don't think Americans are buying it this time. At least I hope not.
Well, they've had it by now. I mean, I just, as I said, I listen to local stations and I hear so many people challenging, the bulldogs that are the vanguards of the right there. And so I believe that people are wising up. And you're right, money-wise, I understand. The Democrats are going to be playing from behind, but the masses are on the side of what is right.
It's just a matter, frankly, I think, and this is one of the reasons why, maybe the primary reason why I'm in radio now and not still working for Congress. I wanted to give people the facts they can use to explain to people on the fence. I mean, if you've got, you know, a right-wing religious conservative, you know, or a racist, I mean, you're not going to convince them. I know that. But
right.
But we got a lot of people in the middle.
Exactly.
And when they use these terms like big spending liberal, how many times you heard that? Big spending liberal. And yet what we've shown is that even the Cato Institute, which is, you know, the premier fiscal conservatives, generally supporting Republicans until this call, right, Chris Edwards, even he agrees that it's the Republicans that are spending, you know, massive wasteful spending, not the Democrats.
I thought that Cato Institute believed in small businesses and things like that.
They do. They do, but they understand that the Republicans are not helping small business. I mean, that's what, to me, is so interesting and why I was really glad to have him on the air. By the way, folks, if you want to join in this conversation, the number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-2667, or email me, Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. But I think that was really very interesting that Cato agrees with me that, you know, these Republicans are just spending massive amounts of money. I mean, 24% a year. And we're not talking about 9/11. I mean, half of it may relate to national security, but the other half is just pure pork, pure corporate welfare.
So it gets to be the point where as, if they get themselves 4 years, I hate to use the old us and they, but it, they get in 4 years, they jam as much as they possibly can in, huh, until the very end, and hope
like,
they'll get elected some other 4 years. And,
like
and
pigs at the trough.
Savings.
Like pigs at the trough.
You're kidding me.
They just go in and grab what they can, eat what they can, put it in their pockets, and go away. I mean, it's you know, when Kerry said... to as a supporter, not even in a speech, you know, this is the most lying, corrupt group I've ever seen.
Right.
I am so glad he didn't apologize, because this is the most lying, corrupt group I've ever seen.
I agree.
Yeah, I said this yesterday on the air. Richard Nixon, when he lied and covered up, right, Richard Nixon had the, well, what's the word? He had the integrity, and that's not a word I often use with Richard Nixon. He had the integrity to know that he was doing a bad thing. he recognized that when he was lying and scheming to the American people, that it was something that was bad, and so he tried to cover it up. And you know, and that's why he was thrown out of office. But these guys, they have no shame.
Are you saying that he basically got caught and said, okay, I got caught, and I am leaving? You know,
I'm saying he tried to cover it up. The point is that
there's nothing new there, though, is
right?
There?
No, but my point is, compare this to the Bush administration. The Bush administration is so blatant.
Bother.
Well, it doesn't bother them, exactly. They say, hey, you know, you went to war because of weapons of mass destruction, and there weren't any there. Don't you think you need to apologize or explain that to the American people? No, we don't have to explain. We were always right. You were always right, but you said they had these weapons of mass destruction. You said they had nuclear power. You said we had to fear a mushroom cloud. We were always right. Go back to sleep. You know,
I get your point. And one after another after another. It's the old don't ask.
Don't challenge me. It's all going well, America.
Right.
Go back to sleep.
Pay
don't
no
challenge
to the
me.
The man behind the curtain.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. It's you know, on Iraq, it was, oh, no, we were always there to save the Iraqi people.
Right.
No. It was, the President Bush, actually, it's interesting, recently said, well, we went into Iraq because they wouldn't let the inspectors in. And that was the most Orwellian comment I ever heard, because I remember a year ago when they let the inspectors in. Is my memory failing me?
I let him in for the second time, I believe.
I mean, is my memory failing me? He's actually trying to change history after it occurs. And I don't think Americans are that stupid. At least I hope not.
He probably didn't really realize they were over there.
Hey, Mike, I really enjoyed this conversation. I got to go to a commercial. Thanks very much for calling. I hope you'll call in again.
Anytime, Mark.
I really enjoy it. Hey, listen, folks, if you want to advertise on the Inside Scoop, if you want to get your product out there, you can do so. Just send an email to advertise@radioinsidescoop.com. And if you want to participate in today's conversation, it's real easy to do. Just dial toll-free 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-2667, or you can send me an email by sending to Mark, M-A-R-K, at radioinsidescoop.com. When we come back, I'm going to play something from The Daily Show. It seems that they have the answer, something that I didn't think was possible, of how gay marriages harm straight people. Frankly, I couldn't think of how that was possible, but on The Daily Show, we've got Stephen Colbert, and he's going to tell you how it's the case. Back with more of The Inside Scoop and your calls right after this.
This is WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Turner. The offshoring avalanche continues. General Motors plans to slash the number of white-collar workers it employs domestically while shipping the jobs overseas. An internal GM memo says, quote, in 2003, we began offshoring activities, moving $3.5 million of work to lower-cost locations, and we are planning to increase that to $48 million in 2004. On Monday, Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm responded to the offshoring threat with two orders giving preferences for state contracts to firms that employ local workers.
The birthplace of the labor union that helped bring democracy to Poland and crack the Iron Curtain faces the wrecking ball courtesy of gentrification. The Solidarity Union got its start in the Gdansk shipyard during a strike in 1980. Now a U.S. developer owns nearly half of it and wants to turn it into a condo and shopping complex. The city's hesitant to see the yard and its 3,000 decent-paying jobs disappear. It supports an alternate redevelopment plan, which would augment the shipyard with affordable housing and new schools, as well as some sort of solidarity museum. The American developers are willing to sell the works back to the Polish, but only at a price several times its market value.
2,200 United Auto Workers Union members in Indiana averted a strike this week, reaching a tentative deal with Guide Corporation, an auto parts supplier for General Motors. The five-year contract proposal preserves health and pension benefits and includes a $3,000 signing bonus. The deal was negotiated under a threat by GM to move to a cheaper offshore supplier unless workers submitted to what officials called a competitive agreement. A ratification vote is scheduled for later this week.
Politics in the workplace is growing, especially in corporate America. This year, 99 of the 150 largest companies in the country are conducting some form of voter registration program for their employees, up from less than 30 2 years ago. Tied into many of these are supplemental voter education efforts, which mostly consist of company-supplied information on candidates' voting records and positions on major issues. Specific company endorsements are forbidden, but the strategy seems to work. Research from the 2002 elections conducted by the Business Industry Political Action Committee boasts that among new voters who cast their ballots based on employer-supplied information alone, more than 60% selected the most business-friendly candidate in contested races.
Here's today's Dow Bob Report. The Bush administration's new prescription drug benefits may make Medicare's finances sick. A report from the Medicare and Social Security Programs Trustees Fund found that the Medicare costs are now estimated to top $500 billion over 10 years. Unless action is taken to curb costs, the fund could become insolvent in 2019, 7 years earlier than forecast last year.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
We're back here on the Inside Scoop. We're taking your calls. The number here is 877-57-SCOOP. That's a toll-free number, 877-57-SCOOP. Call in. Let your voice be heard. We had at the beginning, the first hour, we had a guest from the Cato Institute. Now, the Cato Institute believes in smaller government. They are someone who traditionally have been allied with the Republicans. But what we found is that actually today the Cato Institute is more aligned with the Democrats because the Democrats aren't doing all this wasteful spending. It's the Republicans that are doing the wasteful spending in Congress. So, it's really very interesting that even now we have support from people that you wouldn't ordinarily expect it from. Hey, again, the call number is 877-57-SCOOP. You can also send me an email by sending to Mark, M-A-R-K, at RadioInsideScoop.com. And I got an email from one of my favorite conservative listeners. It's nice that I'm bringing conservatives in. Maybe we can turn a few of them around. His name is Ben. He's written me before. And he agrees with my guest. Now what we had in the first hour that yours truly, Mark Levine, I was arguing with Chris Edwards, the Cato Institute. He agreed with me that Republican spending was too high, but we were disagreeing on tax cuts. I argued that if you give a tax cut to the very wealthy, that doesn't create new jobs. They don't build a new car factory unless there's demand for the cars. And the way to get demand for the cars is to give money to poorer people, to middle class people, upper middle class people even. They're the people, when they get more money in their paycheck, they'll buy a new car. Whereas someone who's already got seven cars and earns millions of dollars, they're not going to buy new cars. And Chris disagrees with me. Well, Ben apparently agrees with Chris, and I want to see if you can follow his logic. And Ben, if I don't understand your email, then you're just going to have to call in or email me again to challenge me, because here's what Ben writes. Quote, "I agree with your guest. It is not always to sell more cars or whatever. What if a new factory lowers the company's overhead cost? Yes, it is possible doing that could cause jobs to be lost. However, another company is going to have to increase their numbers to build the plant so it works out in the end." Did that convince you? Didn't convince me at all. Here Ben's writing that we have a tax cut that might lower overhead costs and cause more jobs to be lost. Hey, Ben, I don't know about your logic. If call in, 877-57-SCOOP, explain this to me, because it doesn't make any sense to me. And I think when you take apart conservative economic arguments, and you don't have to have a degree in economics like I do, you really don't. All you have to do is think it through. A rich guy getting $1 million is not going to spend it as much as 100 middle class people each getting $10,000. I mean, that to be true yourself. If you're struggling to spend money and you get more money, you'll spend it. That'll fuel the economy. If you've already got so much, the only question is going to be, well, do you put it on stocks? Do you put it in bonds? You know, where are you going to put the excess change? Not, do I need the money to pay for my kids' college? So I'm sorry, Ben. You're going to have to try again. You're going to have to convince me more. I did want to move to another topic, though, and the reason is because the Senate is holding hearings this week on the same-sex marriage constitutional amendment. As most of us know, the state of Massachusetts is going to allow all its citizens to get married, not just its straight citizens, but allow gay people to get married, too. Freedom and equality for all. The Republicans, and I shouldn't just say the Republicans, let's just say conservatives, because there's some Democrats, and not all Republicans oppose equality for gay people, but many of them are opposed to gay marriage. And I actually had a long discussion, some of you may have heard, with Peter Sprigg of the Family Research Council. I had that a few weeks ago, where I repeatedly asked him a simple question. How is it that gay marriage harms straight couples? How is it that if you're a straight couple and you're living in Kansas, that the fact that two lesbians are getting married in San Francisco, maybe like Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin have been together 51 years, how is it that their marriage harms you in Nebraska? Are you going to break up? Are you going to divorce your spouse because gay people can get married? And Peter Sprigg said, oh, well, maybe it will cause less straight people to get married in the future. Maybe it'll harm procreation. Really silly arguments. I don't think straight people will stop procreating if gay people get married. And unless you think everybody's gay, I don't think people will stop getting married, straight people, because gay people can. But then I heard the argument that I hadn't heard before. I heard an argument by Stephen Colbert on Jon Stewart's Daily Show. And this, I think, is the best argument that can possibly be made on why straight people may oppose gay marriage. And I want to play it for you and see if you have any comment on it.
With more on the gay marriage controversy, we turn to Daily Show senior moral authority, Stephen Colbert. Stephen, thank you. Stephen, obviously you're something of an expert on relationships, having, by your own count, been involved in over 300 of them by your, I believe, by your 21st birthday.
And 10 more on my 21st birthday, John. It was quite a night.
Stephen, why has same-sex marriage created such a furor?
John, there's a simple fact here. Marriage is a contract between a man and a woman, an often violated, easily broken, eminently disposable contract between a man and a woman. The minute we let gays and female gays...
That's lesbians.
Them. The minute we let them get married, you are breaking down the last societal barrier between our world and their world.
But I think that's the point. I think the point is that when you break down those barriers, that's a metaphor for something positive.
Look, John, the only reason my wife and I got married in the first place was because it was something gays couldn't do. Wedding was conceived entirely as a giant homosexual taunt. But now the vows I made to my wife seem as shallow and empty as the vows I made to my three previous wives.
But I'm not still seeing, and again, I haven't studied it like you have, but how do two people have nothing to do with you? How does their personal decision impact your commitment?
Well, John, here's a for instance stance. My wife and I have been through a bit of a rough patch lately. Over the last few months, I've forgotten our anniversary, her birthday, on several occasions, her name. Now, I ask you, John, is this because of some magic pattern of emotional neglect just dropped down from the sky to ruin my marriage? Isn't it the simpler answer that hundreds of gays were granted judicial permission to seek equal contributory benefits? Connect the dots, man.
But, Stephen.
Oh, and I banged her personal trainer. I'm telling you, it's getting bad.
Well, then I guess, you know, you feel so strongly, you would probably support the constitutional amendment banning same-sex unions.
Absolutely, John. I know a constitutional amendment is a drastic step, but there's a societal trend out there I disagree with, so what other choice is there? We have to defend the institution of marriage.
Well, to defend the institution, then, would you also support perhaps a constitutional amendment against adultery? Because that's really...
Whoa! Listen, comrade. Get your jack-booted thugs out of my bedroom. Or rather, one of several undisclosed bedrooms. Oh, and one time behind the lat machine. That was awesome. She's really fit.
All right, Stephen. Stephen Colbert. We'll be right back.
Well, you've heard it, folks. That is the best argument I've heard against gay marriage. If it is true, as Stephen Colbert says, that, you know, marriages are really, between straight people, they're just done as a giant homosexual taunt, then I guess straight people won't get married if gay people will. Like I said, that's the strongest argument I've ever heard. I got a caller on the line. I want to see what he or she thought about this. Caller, you're on the line. What's your first name and where are you from?
Shannon, and I'm from Augusta, Georgia.
Shannon from Augusta.
From Minnesota, but I'm living in Augusta, Georgia.
Okay, well, Minnesota or Georgia. Thank you. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. How are you?
Hey, thanks. I wanted to respond to that guy who wrote that email about overhead lowering.
Yeah.
How the heck do you lower overhead by building a new factory unless you close the first one?
Well, I
don't see how this happens.
I think that's right, and what he said is that it may well lose jobs. So, I love these arguments by the conservatives. Well, it may well lose jobs, but it will still help the economy. Have you noticed that they're saying that? Hey, look at growth. Growth was up 4%.
They help the economy by making, I don't know, improving stock profits or something
exactly.
like that. Improving profits in the company, and then stock prices go up, and then those who are getting their nice dividend checks.
Exactly.
They're seeing a recovery, and we're sitting here without jobs wondering, you know, how we're going to put food on our families.
That was Bush's comment, putting food on your families.
Yeah.
But you're exactly right.
That, just thought I'd throw that reference in.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, I don't understand. Look, like I said, I don't mean to toot my own horn here. I do have a degree in economics. But one of the things we learn in economics, it's basic economic principle, is that, you know, poor and middle class people are more likely to spend more of their savings than rich people. And
absolutely.
You don't have to be an economist to understand that simple point.
And what can the guy who has everything get for himself?
What does he need?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the only thing I can think of is that I do remember when some of these corporate execs were having huge parties in Greece with, like, naked people and, you know, caviar on ice and, you know, ice statues and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, you know.
Well, that's helping out the Greek economy. What's it doing for us?
Exactly. Exactly. I guess that's how they spend their tax cuts. But for most people just trying to, you know, make a living and afford a car payment and pay rent and send their kids to college, I don't see how giving a tax cut, you know, one of the most interesting tax cuts that Bush really pushed for was ending the estate tax. Now let's think about what the estate tax does. The estate tax is a tax on inherited wealth. Okay? It's money you've never worked for. It's what Anna Nicole Smith, right, got because she married some 80-year-old guy and he kicked off.
And she worked so hard for that money.
Well, you know, hey, you know, she kind of did. I mean, I don't know that I'd want to be with some 80-year-old guy. You know, I don't know that it was worth, for $400 million? I might have to think about that.
For $400
million, I might have to rethink that, huh? But in any case, what's interesting is that, and then I always hear it, just these canards that you know are untrue. When I was working in Congress, a Republican had this thing, well, small businesses and small farmers, you know, will have to pay estate taxes. So the Democrats said, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to allow the first $4 million tax-free. They later raised it to $6 million tax-free.
And they said, $1.5 million.
Well, it started out $1.5 million before they passed this bill, which basically ended estate taxes. The Democrats had a compromise. What Bush wanted to do was take it from $1.5 million down to $2 million, down to $4 million, down to $6 million until, I think it's 2009. That's the lucky year to kill off your rich relatives. There's no estate tax at all. And then it all comes back the next year. Typical Republican planning. But, the Democrats said, look, we'll make you a deal. Instead, we'll actually have more tax cuts now. On the estate tax even, but we're gonna make it consistent. We're gonna make it $2 million per person, which is $4 million per couple. That's how I got the $4 million figure. And that means that, if a couple dies, they can leave up to $4 million to their kids. Now, and then after that,
tax free.
Exactly.
What rate?
Exactly. It goes about 50% is the rate. They have to give off about half to the government. Now, the Republicans said, no. $4 million? That's not enough. I mean, how are you going to live on $4 million? You know,
I don't think I could.
It's hard. I mean, $4 million, I mean, the interest on that, you know, I mean, you might have to continue to work. I don't think so, but you might. You might. I mean, they seem to believe that it's the right of every American, you know, who is the scion of a rich family, never to work again. Never to work again. They need that $4 million. So the Democrats said, all right. $4 million's not enough. How about $6 million? Republicans said no. How about $8 million? Republicans said no. And my favorite vote, they got almost no press, but I remember when it happened in Congress, is there was an amendment by Russ Feingold of Wisconsin. Go Senator Feingold. He said, all right, $100 million tax free, but if you get more than $100 million, you have to pay taxes on it. And they took a vote, and the vote was no. Every single Republican said, we can't tax if you inherit more than $100 million.
That's good, though.
Can you believe that they took that vote?
When the Democrats take back over Congress, they're going to get rid of that whole, get rid of the whole idea of getting rid of the estate tax.
You know, it's ridiculous because here we have people, you know, you have the Social Security tax, which is regressive. It's not like everybody pays a percentage of their income. If you're poor or middle class, then you pay the 6.2% FICA that everybody knows about and your employer matches it. If you make more than $80,000, you pay zero. Zero. I mean,
I thought it was you pay a percentage on the first 80.
That's right.
85.
That's correct. It's 87,000.
Over that is not taxed at all for FICA.
That's exactly right. That's exactly the point I was trying to make. That the first 80 grand or so is taxed, and if you make $1 million, you pay taxes on that 80 grand.
The 80 grand.
And if you make 80 grand, you pay taxes on the 80 grand. And that's why it's an aggressive tax, because if you make 80 grand, you're paying 6.2% of your income. If you make 800,000, you're paying
0.662%.
Exactly, of your income. You're paying a tenth. So this is a regressive tax. So if Bush really believed in tax cutting, which is what he says he believes in, if he really believed in tax cutting to help American people, well, he cuts Social Security tax, because that's something that everybody pays, and not the estate tax, which is only paid by those few people who are lucky enough to have somebody who has $100 million die on them.
But it's that little thing that they could stick in, call it the death tax, and make it sound all scary, and turn it into this horrible thing. Oh, the Democrats, they want to take away the money after you die, so you can't do anything about it because you're dead.
Well, you know, frankly, when I think about it, I'd much rather tax someone who's dead than someone who's living. I mean, after all, if you're living, you know, you're trying to earn a living. You're trying to make ends meet. I guess I don't even think dead people should vote. Call me crazy. But I actually think that only live people should be able to vote, not dead people. And I think that I'd rather tax the dead than the living. Because
they don't have to buy food. They don't have to pay the electric.
Exactly. You know, I mean, I actually think that living people should have more rights than dead people. Now, if you disagree, you call in 877-57-SCOOP. If you think that dead people should have more rights, I don't think so. Hey, thanks very much for your call. I appreciate it. Hey, we got to go to a break. We got one more commercial. I hope you will support independent radio. We talked early on about how there's so few independent media sources. And one of the ways to do that is to donate to Radio Power, radiopower.org, which streams my show. Another way to do that is to contact your local radio station and ask them to carry this feed. You know, we found that radio stations in San Francisco and here in Washington, D.C., very liberal cities. Washington, D.C. is like 70% Democrats. And if you look at the whole area in the Washington Beltway, which is basically suburban Virginia and Maryland, it's 60-plus percent Democrats. And would you believe I am the only talk show host on AM radio in Washington, D.C. that is left of center? I'm not talking leftist liberal. I'm just saying left of center. Everyone else, you have all these right-wing people in this very Democratic town. So what you can do is you can call your local radio station in Augusta, Georgia, all right, Shannon or Mike from Minnesota, call your or whoever we had from Denver, call your local radio station, tell them you got to hear both sides. You know, the way democracy works is when you hear both sides. I'd love it if they put me on the air, but if they put someone else on the air, it's just important to get both sides. That's how democracy works, and it's only in dictatorial countries, right, where they only show one side. And we shouldn't be that kind of a country. We're going to be back with the last 15 minutes of the Inside Scoop right after these messages.
today on Hightower Radio. I have been to the cross, and I have felt the passion. Not Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion, where viewers get to see a Jesus character beaten to a bloody pulp and then graphically crucified on a cross. No, there's nothing at all holy or redeeming about the cross I have witnessed. It's a political cross, marking the spot in Austin, Texas, where the GOP's diabolical hatchet man, Tom DeLay, beat our state's representative democracy to a pulp. This simple wooden cross, nailed to a telephone pole, is 4 feet high, painted white, and hand-lettered. The cross piece says, Democracy. The centerpiece says, R.I.P., killed by Tom DeLay on this spot. Tom, of course, is the nutball Republican majority leader of the U.S. House, who stormed into the Texas state capitol last year and used the GOP's total control of state government to ram through a grossly partisan, contorted piece of raw gerrymandering that autocratically redraws our state's congressional districts and steals half a dozen seats from the Democrats, a theft that will alter the balance of power in Washington. Austin has long had its own coherent congressional district, logical for a state capital and a community of shared interests. DeLay's power grab, however, fractures our city into three shards of incoherent districts that are dominated by populations far from our borders. Stand in central Austin at 38th and Ronson Streets, where the telephone pole cross was erected, and you are at the epicenter of the fracture. Step in one direction and you're in a district controlled by San Antonio's Republican suburbs. Step in another direction and you're in a district running 300 miles away to the Rio Grande Valley. Step again and you're in a district controlled by Houston's Republican suburbs. This is Jim Hightower saying, a majority of Austinites now have congressional districts without representation. There once was a revolution over that anti-democratic principle.
Federal college loan rates are currently lower than they have ever been, which means by refinancing now, you could cut your monthly student loan payment by up to 50%. By calling 1-800-2-COLLEGE, you'll quickly be connected to College Loan Corporation. We will answer your questions, help you lower your payments, and secure a rate as low as 2.63%. It's easy, it's free, and so far, over 300,000 people have called. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
When you're the voice of reason, very few things get you excited, so you wouldn't expect something like a good price on a great copier to be one of them. But when the subject is a Xerox digital copier that delivers 35 quality pages a minute for a surprisingly low lease price of $134 a month, and is so advanced it can be upgraded to scan, fax, and even email, well, that's enough to even make the voice of reason pick up the phone.
Call 1-800-ASK-XEROX for business lease details. Additional per copy charge.
We're back here on the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, former congressional attorney, bringing you all the news from Washington that the government does not want you to know. We're wrapping up our broadcast. There's still time for one more call if you want to call in at 877-57-SCOOP. 877-577-2667. We were discussing earlier on the massive growth in Republican spending. Now, I know the Republicans talk about big spending liberals all the time, but I had someone from the Cato Institute, that traditional conservative organization that supports smaller government, agree with me that Republican spending is out of hand, that it's gone up 24% under Bush and only 2% under Clinton. And they're not spending on the right things, folks. You know, I support spending on a lot of things. One of the things I support spending on is Homeland Security. But most of this new spending is for things like corporate welfare, things like giving tax benefits to Halliburton and to companies that are moving offshore for American jobs. And it's not going to where we need it, protecting our nuclear plants, protecting our chemical plants. You know, one of the things I still find shocking is that here we have a 9/11 commission that's giving testimony today. People are talking about what we could have done to prevent 9/11, and they're pointing fingers back and forth, and they're saying quite rightly that George Bush wasn't focused on intelligence like he should have been. But they're not focusing on what we can do in America to make ourselves safer. Look, folks, use a little logic here. And last time I said this, I was accused by one emailer of helping the terrorists, but I got to tell you something. I don't think the terrorists need my help. They're very smart people. Think about it, folks. The terrorists did not use weapons of mass destruction from Iraq. They didn't bring in anthrax from Baghdad. They didn't ship it in and use it in our subways. No, no. What did they do? They took American planes and hijacked them and flew them into American buildings. They used our own power against us. That's what they did. And so does it really take a rocket scientist to imagine they could do the same thing? They could do a truck bomb a la Timothy McVeigh and run it into a chemical plant or a nuclear plant? I mean, is it that hard to figure out? I think they can. And one of the things the Democrats have been trying to do is harden those targets. And I'm not going to say which targets. I'm not going to tell you that much because I don't want to help the terrorists. But I'll tell you this. Please contact your representative and tell them that you want to be protected from your own chemical and nuclear plants. Because I'll tell you what I fear. And I do not want to be a prophet on this one, folks. I fear not anthrax from Baghdad. I fear anthrax from Fort Detrick, Maryland. I fear biological and chemical weapons from DuPont factories where someone goes in and blows it up. And we have got to protect these things. And I know the chemical plants don't want to harden their targets because that costs money. But this, my friends, is money well spent. And if the corporations don't want to do it, we just have to pass a law and make them do it. So there's definitely spending that I support. But what we've gone over in the first hour was all manner of pork barrel spending, whether it's Ted Stevens helping out crab distributors in Alaska and insisting that only the ones that give to his campaign can get crabs, Alaskan king crab, to people supporting rainforests in Iowa. We have got some really, really stupid spending proposals. But again, as I pointed out to the Cato Institute, and here's where we started to disagree, the tax cuts are even more causing the deficit than spending. Spending's about a quarter of the deficit problem, and three quarters are caused by insufficient tax revenues. Now, if you divide that up again, another quarter of that three quarters, that's due to the weakness in the economy. Bush claims the economy is doing so well. Well, I think we know that with our own eyes, but the clearest way is look at tax revenues. They're way down. They're way down. One quarter of that is based on the bad economy. And the other half of the deficit? Well, that half of the deficit is based on George Bush's tax cuts, based on his tax cuts to the very wealthy. So that's what's causing the deficit, folks, and the only way to get rid of it is to undo some of those tax cuts. And they're going to tar Kerry. They're going to call Kerry big spending liberal and big taxer, but if you want to avoid the deficits on our children, what you've got to do is support Kerry's plan to increase taxes only for those making over 200 grand and to lower taxes for the middle class. I got a caller. You got time? A few more minutes for a last comment. Caller, you're on the air. What's your first name? Where are you from?
Name is Gary. I live in Colorado.
Okay, Gary from Colorado. What do you think about what I've been saying?
Oh, very interesting. You were talking about encouraging people to talk with their Congress critters.
Right.
Well, I happen to live in one of those districts where we have a Congress critter who's hopeless.
Yep. You were gerrymandered into it, huh?
Well, no, we've been here for a while.
Oh, okay.
It's a sleazebucket guy named Joel Heffley.
Oh, I know who he is.
In Colorado Springs, and,
yep,
and he's been getting elected and reelected for since dirt was around.
Yeah, there are a lot of right-wing conservatives in Colorado,
yeah,
Springs.
Yeah, and so talking to him really isn't very satisfying, although I have to admit I've had a few heated conversations with him over the years.
Well, here's how you can help. Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell is going to be retiring.
Isn't that
and
great?
The Democrats can take that seat. Colorado is definitely not a hopeless cause. As you know, Colorado, I believe, voted for Clinton in one of the two times. Colorado is a state that we can get back as a swing state. So if your representative is hopeless, work on your senator.
Yeah, and I certainly agree that that's a good approach to take. I've been finding myself recently sending campaign contributions to Congress people in other districts around.
Well, that makes sense too.
Is there any organized thought around that?
Yeah, here's what I do. What I do is I go to the Democratic National Committee. And I would ask them, and it may not matter so much now as in the time between the fall and November, so take that money, set it aside, and be ready to go. I would ask the DNC where the close races are. And they will tell you, we got a close race, Alabama 4th District or New Hampshire 1st District, whatever it is. They will tell you where the money's most needed. And that's actually a great idea because you're right. Why throw money after a cause that probably isn't going to succeed? Better to let it tip where it matters. And the Democrat National Committee, they've got huge charts and everything. They're doing polling numbers. And that's actually a great way to figure out where your money can go.
Given the failure of the geographical-based congressional and representative system, it seems to me that it's time for people like me to start picking my congressmen from somewhere else in the U.S.
Well, you know, there's something else you can do, Gary, right?
Yeah.
What you can do, in addition, is focus on your state legislator. Colorado, I believe you just redistricted, didn't you?
Well, it's back in the courts again.
Good. I'm glad it's in the courts. Colorado, actually, a lot of people don't know this, even predated Texas. Now, Texas has many more representatives, so it was a much nastier job. You may have heard Jim Hightower talking about Austin.
Well, they had delay there, too.
Exactly. But Colorado did the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. Colorado, in fact, was the first state in more than 50 years to redistrict outside of the 10 years. Let me just explain. You probably know this, Gary, but maybe some of my listeners don't. The Constitution requires we do a census every 10 years. And that census is to make sure that the state districts that represent us in the House of Representatives are proportionally based on population, because obviously populations change. And it's been the tradition for more than half a century, and indeed for most of our history, there's been very few cases, and none in the last half century until just recently. What they said is every 10 years we're going to go and we're going to change those districts as we're required to do by the Constitution, but we're not going to change them the rest of the time because it's a purely partisan act. You get those crazy districts like the ones I mentioned in Florida. Well, Tom DeLay has said, you know what? I'm not going to follow this tradition. I'm going to do these purely partisan acts, and they started it in Colorado. I'm glad it's in the courts. I hope it gets defeated. And then they moved on to Texas. And I guess it's a long-winded way of saying to you, Gary, what you can do is focus on your local Colorado state legislators. Focus on them. I don't know. Maybe they're hopeless, too. But you have a much better chance of influencing that campaign. Most people probably don't even know who their state legislators are. You could work in the campaign to unseat if you had a local Republican guy, or even work in a neighboring district, which isn't so far away, and get them to undo that redistricting. And if you do that, you might get more House representatives that you like just by focusing on your state legislator.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So that's a really good way to do that. Hey, I gotta close up. Last words, any?
Yeah, I'd like to see more people stressing representation outside of geographic areas. Thank you much.
Okay, well, thanks very much. I thought that was a very good point that Gary made, that you can definitely help in other districts with money. And, again, you can hope with your state legislators as well. We only got a couple minutes left. I do want to read one email that also talks about gerrymandering. It's from Jay from Maine, and he says he shows a site. He emails me a site with a printable map of all the current congressional districts. Great to see how silly it is. And that's nationalatlas.gov/congdistprint.html. So nationalatlas.gov/congdistprint.html. And he writes, Florida 20 and 22 are good examples of what I was talking about. Hey, you know, you can make a difference, and more than just protesting. You know, we have Gary mentioned it in Colorado. Go work for your state representative. Work to change your national representative. We've got to take America back. And one way to do that is by listening to independent radio, by listening to my show every day. We got it weekdays, 3 to 5 p.m. Eastern time. Coming up later on in the week, tomorrow and Friday, we're going to talk about the situation in Israel. Very controversial topic. I know that the leader of Hamas was just killed by Israel. I want to know what you think about that and what you think about terrorism in general. We're going to go over to the 9/11 Commission. We're going to talk about some of the testimony that's gone on there and whether the Bush administration is doing a good job or not in the war against terrorism. If you want information about me or the Inside Scoop, all you have to do is go to my website, radioinsidescoop.com. RadioInsideScoop.com. Go there. Take a look at who I am. Send me an email. Agree or disagree. This is your forum. And please tune in tomorrow for the next edition of The Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine signing off.